You're listening to Central Time, right here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you're looking for more meaningful friendships or seeking connection beyond the screen, the author of a new book called The Art of Showing Up has some practical tips to get you started. That's coming up in just a little bit. Now, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley is getting criticized after reportedly taking steps to ensure former President Donald Trump could not launch a military strike at the end of his presidency. The revelations come from the new book, Peril, by Washington Post journalists Bob Woodward and Robert Costa. They report that General Milley twice assured his Chinese counterpart that Trump would not launch an attack, and that Milley asked senior military officials to alert him if an attack was attempted. We're talking about what this means and why some are saying Milley violated the principle of civilian control of the military. You can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the steps General Mark Milley reportedly took? How do you feel about Milley's concerns that President Trump could have launched an attack at the end of his presidency? And if you are a member of the military or a veteran, call in now and share your thoughts. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Risa Brooks is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University and an adjunct scholar at West Point's Modern War Institute. She's also a senior associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. Risa, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So this story about General Mark Milley has gotten a lot of traction over the last few days. What was your reaction to this story?
Well, I think, like many people, when I first heard about it, I was somewhat shocked, given the framing and the language that was reported in the Washington Post article covering the book that's about to be published. But I think after that, I sort of had a reaction of, okay, well, let's step back, take a deep breath, and consider that this controversy is stemming from the release of a couple of snippets from a book we haven't yet read, and we don't really know the context of, and we don't know whether we would agree with the author's interpretation of what's happening there. So I think my first reaction was shock, and my second reaction was, huh, I wonder what really is going on in this story. And since that time, we've had some more news about those events that have filled out a little bit of that context.
And what additional context have we gotten in the last couple of days that has maybe changed, you know, what you have thought about this?
Yeah, so I'm still sorting out exactly what I think about it, but here's some of the things that we now know. We know, for example, so there were two phone calls that have caused this sort of uproar. One was in late October, and then a second was 2 days after the protesters took over the Capitol on January 6th, so that call was on January 8th. And we know now that in October, as was reported at the time, there were phone calls and conversations a few days before Milley's call with the Chinese, with State Department officials, with Department of Defense officials, basically that were conveying the same message that Milley then supposedly shared a couple of days later. And when Milley was on that call in October, he wasn't alone in a room sort of going rogue. There were 15 other officials in the room, and Secretary of Defense Mark Esper, who was later fired by Donald Trump, at that time he was Secretary of Defense, has said that he was well aware and approved of those conversations. In addition, while the subsequent acting Secretary of Defense that replaced Mark Esper has said that he didn't approve the second phone call, there were at that time a similar number of officials, including State Department officials, in the room, and the message was, you know, not something that was outside of institutional channels. So I think knowing that context is helpful to understanding the perception that this was something that that Millie might have done on the sly and that wasn't sort of part of a larger initiative.
We're talking to Risa Brooks right now. She's an associate professor of political science at Marquette University and an adjunct scholar at West Point's Modern War Institute. She's also a senior associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in D.C. And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. And I do want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Roger in Madison. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I totally support the general. If this guy was that unhinged, I'm glad somebody had the cojones to step up to the plate and make the call. We didn't need a nuclear war.
Roger, thank you so much for that call. And, you know, part of the last 4 years has been looking at the Trump presidency through what kind of felt like a little bit of a loose cannon sometimes. Could that have been playing a potential role here?
Certainly, I think there were concerns after the election by some people that were close to the White House, including some of Donald Trump's own advisors, that maybe he had taken the loss badly and had retreated. I mean, he wasn't seen in public for a period of time. And I think that might, that context of, you know, what is going on with the commander-in-chief could have been a piece of it. But I think it's also the larger context is that the U.S. and China were in not a great place at this time. I mean, China is a big adversary of the U.S., as many people know, but there hadn't been any high-level talks for nearly a year. There had been a lot of bellicose rhetoric coming from the administration, and, you know, legitimate fears, I think, that tensions needed to be tamped down. So part of this may have more to do with China than to do with Donald Trump per se.
Well, let's hear what President Trump had, or former President Trump had to say. He was on Newsmax this week responding to this news. Let's take a listen.
So first of all, if it is actually true, which is hard to believe, that he would have called China and done these things and was willing to advise them of an attack or in advance of an attack, that's treason. And I would think I've had so many calls today saying that's treason.
So former President Trump on Newsmax saying that this could be treasonous. You know, how do you respond to that?
What do I think of that? I think that if Mark Milley on his own usurped civilian authority, that would be very serious, and I would agree with that. I think we're not sure that that's exactly what happened. And I would want more information before coming to such a judgment. I'm going to add something, though, which I think is a reflection a bit of the caller and his sentiments that he expressed. And I think it's also apparent in, you know, Trump's comments just now, which is that this has had a very, very negative effect in sort of creating this turning Mark Milley and this incident into a lightning rod for partisan bickering and arguments. And I don't mean to imply that of your caller, but just in general, people are very polarized about this issue, independent of the facts. Those who are supporters and sympathetic to Donald Trump are likely to rapidly agree that it must have been treason, whereas those who are more skeptical of Donald Trump might be more likely to praise Mark Milley. And I think that is one of the byproducts, this sort of politicization, putting the military in the persona of Mark Milley into the center of politics. That's one of the long-term sort of really negative byproducts of this whole incident.
We are talking to Risa Brooks right now. She's an expert on civil-military relations with Marquette University and West Point's Modern War Institute. And she's with us today to talk about revelations that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, took steps to avert a military strike during President Trump's final days in office. And we'll talk about how the concept of civilian control of the military fits into that conversation in just a moment. Now, you can call in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Is the civilian control of the military important to you? What do you think about the politicization of the military? And if you are a military family or you were in the armed forces, we want to hear from you and get your opinions. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org, and we will continue this conversation and take your calls right here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We are picking up our talk with Risa Brooks. She's an expert on civil-military relations at Marquette University and West Point's Modern War Institute. And she's with us to talk about civilian control of the military and why some critics say Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, violated it. There is that news coming out from a forthcoming book that says Milley called his equivalent in China to potentially keep them abreast of how former President Trump was handling military endeavors to avoid a strike. And we want to hear your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Risa, one thing that, you know, as this story has been unfolding over the last couple of days, obviously many organizations on both sides of the political spectrum have opinions on this. And one thing that stood out to me was a piece in the National Review that pointed out that, you know, say what you will about President Trump, but he was maybe the only president in recent memory, maybe the last one being President Jimmy Carter in the 70s, who really didn't get involved in military skirmishes, didn't start anything. Is that correct? Is that true?
Start military skirmishes? I mean, certainly, if you want to go by the metric of starting wars, neither, you know, Barack Obama didn't start any wars. He inherited wars. So I'm not sure that characterization, and then Donald Trump also inherited those same wars, mm-hmm. Especially in Afghanistan, right? And famously, mm-hmm. we know he was not interested in and had a plan and had actually sent a memo with his signature to abruptly pull out all forces by January 15th. So I'm not sure that characterization is actually accurate, but maybe it just depends on what the author intended by that terminology.
Sure. Now, I want to take a look quickly at former President Trump's first impeachment trial. Alexander Vindman was a witness, and he was also a veteran. And he, in response to this news, tweeted that Milley, quote, violated the sacrosanct principle of civilian control over the military. And before we get to that specific idea, can you tell us about the broad concept of civil-military relations?
Yes, thanks so much for asking about that. And I think if there's one silver lining from this whole incident, it's that, you know, the regular public, most people who don't think about these issues are kind of have hopefully a greater understanding of that concept. So civil-military relations refer to a set of relationships between the military and society, and sometimes people talk about intra-military relationships in this context, but I think what most people are thinking about is how the political leadership, the president, Congress, political appointees in the Department of Defense, and the uniformed military interact. And the way that interaction is supposed to work in the U.S. and actually in any democratic country is that civilian elected leaders have the final say over how the military is to be used. And the theory is that those civilian leaders are directly accountable to voters and can be voted out. out if the public doesn't like the decisions they're making about how to use the military. And the military is an executive department. It's part of the Department of Defense. It is not directly accountable and therefore should be deferring to those elected political leaders.
And so with this specific incident, we've just heard that Alexander Vindman was very critical of Mark Milley here. How does civilian control of the military fit into this issue?
Sure. So I think that the underlying sort of the snippets of the book taken in the context in which they're presented and assuming that the interpretation of what actually happened and the complete story is there, you know, suggest to people like Vindman that maybe Mark Milley was saying something like, Donald Trump can't start a nuclear war without following usual customary procedures, which is consulting with the uniformed military about that, including himself. Now, Mark Milley, as chairman, is not in the chain of command, meaning that he doesn't have any role in ordering or conducting forces in the course of war, and so technically doesn't have any of that power. But by custom, these folks are usually consulted. And so for him to supposedly assert that he would require this, that President Trump couldn't start a nuclear war without, you know, consulting him or the others, could be seen by somebody like Alexander Vindman as a violation of civilian control of the military. Now, there's some dispute over whether that's actually what Milley was saying. Milley is known to be kind of brusque and in how he speaks. So I think that there's some I'm personally still uncertain about exactly if that was what Milley was saying. But if you do think that, then yes, that would be a violation of civilian control of the military. In the United States, should a president, Donald Trump or any other one, choose to initiate a nuclear attack on an adversary, that is the prerogative of that commander-in-chief.
We are talking to Risa Brooks right now. She's an expert on civil-military relations and associate professor of political science at Marquette University. And I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Tony in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Tony.
Hello. Here's my opinion. I believe that it's correct that General Milley did violate some of the rules, but I think also, in wisdom, somebody needs to know when the rules need to be broken. The United States was in a situation where China and a lot of other countries were looking at our president and saying, is this guy really all there? China was going to full alert. By avoiding a war, by breaking the rules, I think the guy has done a real service to the nation. He's probably going to have to fall on his sword and resign or whatever. But you know what? If he kept us out of a war, I think it was damn worth it. I take my hat off to him.
Tony, thank you so much for that call. So, Risa, given what Tony just said, what is your reaction?
So, I think Tony really captures really well the sort of underlying dilemma here, which is, you know, the country has traditions and what some people call norms and ways of doing things for a reason, because they uphold the democratic order. And without abiding those conventions and norms, things don't work. People, you know, things break down. Having said that, I think a lot of the judgment about where people will come down, if they do conclude that civilian control was violated, comes down to the kind of calculus that Tony sort of presented, which is this is a really dire situation, and sometimes you have to break the rules. I think this phrase you might have heard, the Constitution is not a suicide pact, is sort of apt description of people who come down in that way on the issue.
Now, Tony also mentioned sort of an optics question, too, which is that he anticipates that, to quote Tony, that Milley will have to fall on the sword, basically, depending on how this plays out. On a political level, do you think that those conversations could be happening?
So I think if I've seen in the news that President Biden has said that he has confidence in Milley, at least at this point in time, I think that, you know, there's reasons for Milley to stay in his job. And let me describe what that reasoning would be. A few years ago, the law was changed. It used to be that chairman only served for 2 years. And the law was changed by Congress to make it that chairman of the Joint Chiefs would serve for a four-year term. And that the reasoning there is that they were trying to sort of depoliticize the position, mm-hmm. that to provide some insulation. Somebody's in office for a long period of time. They're sort of more insulated from the pressures of the day. And so by that reasoning, if Biden fires or puts pressure, actually asks for him to resign, which is normally how it works, there would be, you know, that's sort of politicizing the situation even further by putting Milley and holding him up as really sort of this political figure rather than sort of trying to dampen down the situation, which is, I think, what the administration is trying to do now. Whether he keeps his position or not, I think, remains to be seen. I think we don't know. I mean, Milley's, you know, part of the job description and also just his personality and the way he speaks, he's been a pretty big lightning rod, not just for this issue, but being pulled into the culture wars, all sorts of things. So I don't envy his role right now, for sure.
Risa, thank you so much for joining us today and breaking this all down for us.
Oh, absolutely.
Risa Brooks is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University and an adjunct scholar at West Point's Modern War Institute. She's also a non-resident senior associate in the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. And she was with us today to talk about the principle of civilian control of the military and why some critics have said that Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley violated it in an effort to prevent former President Trump from launching an alleged military strike at the end of his presidency, and that is alleged in a forthcoming book. You are listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Coming up later, many school board meetings are getting out of control. 1A host Jen White looks at what's behind the shouting matches and the efforts by parents and activists to shake up our schools. That's today on 1A Plus after 6. Now, we all know we should be taking care of ourselves, checking up on others in our lives, taking a break from our phones once in a while, and honestly, the list could go on. It could be our ticket to more meaningful friendships, more meaningful lives, but how often do we actually do that? Our next guest wrote a guide that is practical, realistic, and lays out exactly what we need to be better at being there for ourselves and being there for others. And we want to hear from you. Call in now at 800-642-1234. How do you find yourself showing up for others? Are you actively trying to get better at paying attention to how our friends and family are doing? Have you recently tried making new friends, or is there a hobby that you do just for yourself? Call in with your experience. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest now is Rachel Wilkerson Miller. She's a deputy editor at Vice and author of The Art of Showing Up, How to Be There for Yourself and Your People. Rachel, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, how are you doing?
I am well, and I'm really excited to talk to you about this because the art of showing up, just the actual act of doing it, is way easier said than done. So can you talk about what it means to show up?
Definitely. So I think of it as first and foremost about bearing witness to your own life and to the things you're going through, and then to the things that other people around you are going through. But beyond that, I think you can kind of break it down into four steps. So it's noticing, you're just perceiving behaviors, words, circumstances that are communicating a need. It doesn't have to be that deep. It can just be like, I'm noticing I feel tired today. Beyond that, it's processing. It's using the knowledge that you already have about yourself, about the person that you've noticed this in, and kind of running it through that lens of what else does this connect to? Have I been tired every day this week? Okay, that's interesting. It's also naming the thing, just the what's really going on here. Is there something deeper that this reveals? Sometimes noticing and naming are really similar, just saying I'm tired or I'm really exhausted. I think exhausted, you can see how using a different word, naming it as such, makes it feel a little different. And then the fourth step is responding. So that can be as simple as like, I need to go to sleep a little bit earlier tonight. Or if a friend, if you're noticing this in a friend, maybe you say, hey, every time we've hung out, you've mentioned that you're feeling really exhausted. Is everything okay? Do you need anything? What, you know, what's going on? So that's how I think of it. A lot of times we do these things automatically, but it can also be helpful to slow down and kind of make sure you're doing all of them.
Well, people, and I will include myself in this, sometimes go on autopilot. If someone asks how I am, I might say, oh, I'm fine. Or they, if I ask, you know, the same question, they might be like, oh yeah, everything's fine. And it feels like that fine has become a catch-all, even when things may not be fine. How do you, as part of showing up, both for yourself and for others, you know, kind of tease that out?
Yeah, I think that, you know, sometimes it's tough because things are fine, all things considered, even when you're doing really badly. And that can be a hard thing to communicate. But sometimes when I'm going through a rough time, I'll say that I can, you know, I might say like, you know, everything is pretty good in so many areas of my life, but I'm feeling really bummed about this one thing, or I've been not feeling physically well lately, or just being specific. You know, we're complicated people, and you can just bring up these small things that are maybe chipping away at your overall sense of well-being without it having to be, you know, like opening up and being really vulnerable about every little thing that's going on in your life. Sometimes it's enough to just say like, you know, I've been having a little bit of a hard time lately going to sleep at night, or connecting with my kids, or whatever the case may be.
We are talking to Rachel Wilkerson Miller right now, deputy editor at Vice, and she's the author of The Art of Showing Up, How to Be There for Yourself and Your People. Now, let's look at this book. It's in two parts. One part is focused on showing up for yourself, and the other part is showing up for others. Why was it important for you to, you know, kind of pull these two issues apart?
Well, I think that it's twofold. First, you just simply can't show up for other people unless you're showing up for yourself. And I think we all know that on some level. We've heard the metaphor of like, put your own oxygen mask on before helping other people. But that doesn't mean we always do it. It's easy to say, oh, that applies to other people, or yeah, but I'm too busy right now. So I think it's like really important to stop and spend a lot of time there. Because if you don't show up for yourself, you're going to get overextended, you're going to get resentful, you're going to burn out. So I think that's so important. But also, I actually think that the same sort of advice and process applies to both things. And once you start showing up for yourself and going through the process of saying, why do I do certain things, or what do I need, and having compassion for yourself, it becomes so much easier to show up for other people, because you realize like, oh, sometimes I'm a little cranky when I haven't had lunch or something to that effect. And so then when somebody else is a little cranky, you can say, hey, are you okay? Or do you need something to eat? So it's just like, once you recognize these things in yourself, it's so much easier to extend the compassion and the grace to others.
Well, and part of that is getting to know yourself. We all are the narrator and the hero of our own story, even if maybe sometimes we're the anti-hero in our own story. How do you advise people to challenge the narratives that they have either set up for themselves, or the narratives that have been set up for themselves by other people?
I think one thing that can be really helpful is just sitting down and thinking through, what are my values, which sounds a little corny or maybe a little forced. But when you sit and think through it, you probably will start to realize, oh, I actually do. When you look at a list of values, it's pretty easy to be like, oh, not that, not that. Yes, this. And you realize so many of the decisions you make in a given day are tied to your values. Like, they really underpin everything we do. So I think that's a really great place to start. And you can start to think about, okay, what are my values? And then what are my priorities? You know, maybe my values are family and friendship, but my priority this year is my career. So even though I really value this thing, I'm going to put it on the back burner consciously. And I think that's also really helpful to know why you're doing things. So looking at values and priorities is a really good way to do it. But a more fun way to do it that I always recommend is doing personality tests, which, you know, I don't know if personality tests work in the sense that you can diagnose someone's entire personality. But I find that asking the questions of yourself and kind of going through the little quizzes or whatever the case may be makes makes you think about, you know, how do you respond to certain things and what makes you different from your friends, and talking through your results with other people, you often start to have a conversation of them saying, oh yeah, you're totally like that. And you, maybe you're like, am I really? And so you start to kind of uncover things about yourself in a way that can actually be really helpful, but that's also kind of fun and playful and not too serious.
Now, one exercise that you also recommend in your book, and for me, it feels like it could be a little bit scary. Maybe it's, I imagine it's quite helpful, and I'm actually going to go do it. But it's doing a personal audit of our time. And I don't know if other people get this, but the time you spend on your phone when you get that report on Sunday, it always makes me a little irritated because I don't want to confront it. But why might a time audit be really beneficial for people?
Well, I think at the end of the day, it's just helpful to see how you actually spend your time, because we probably all have an idea in our head of how we spent it and how much time we spend doing different things. And when you do get that screen report or whatever the case may be, and you realize, oh my God, you know, I'm telling people I'm too busy to hang out, and really I'm just spending all of that time on my phone. It's kind of a wake-up call. But, you know, I think it just helps you kind of recalibrate and decide, okay, do I want to be spending that much time on my phone? And maybe you're in a place where you're like, I'm having a hard time right now, and like looking at certain apps actually makes me feel more connected with people or makes me feel better, and that's okay. But if you're looking to get more time back, or you're wondering how come I can't get out of bed in the morning, or why am I always rushing in the morning, and it's like, oh, because I'm spending an hour in bed scrolling, that's really helpful and it's a fairly easy thing to fix. So I think just going through how you spend your time, and if you're happy with it, can help you decide, okay, where do I want to shift things to feel a little bit better at the end of the day or at the end of the week, and feel like I'm not wasting my time, that I'm spending it the way that I want to be spending it.
Right now, we are talking with Rachel Wilkerson Miller, author of The Art of Showing Up, How to Be There for Yourself and for Your People. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's a small thing that you do to show people in your lives that you're listening and that you're really paying attention? What do you do for yourself so you can be more present in your other relationships? And what have you done to maintain your friendships? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and we will take your calls and continue this conversation right here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our talk with Rachel Wilkerson Miller, a deputy editor at Vice and the author of The Art of Showing Up, How to Be There for Yourself and Your People. And you can join the conversation now at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Rachel about her book and about how you can show up for other people? What steps have you taken in your own life to be more present? Call now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Rachel, one thing that comes up a lot is sort of a culture of being comfortable canceling plans or flaking on things. I keep making admissions on the air, but sometimes I love when people cancel on me, and sometimes I love canceling on other people, but then later feel less good about that. Can you talk a little bit about how you think of, you know, canceling plans or just general flakiness?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm also guilty of feeling relieved when somebody cancels. Sometimes I have to cancel myself. So I don't think it's the worst thing in the world. I just think it's really important to be thoughtful and intentional about it, and don't just cancel without a second thought. So first and foremost, better have a good reason, and then communicate that reason to the person that you're canceling on, and then sort of immediately offer to reschedule so that it communicates, I care about you. You know, today is a problem, but I still really want to see you. So I think that's really important. But I think also thinking through like what the cost is to them. So if you had tickets to go to something together and, you know, you really want to bail, maybe you offer to pay the cost of their ticket since you're inconveniencing them. Or, you know, if you have to cancel your manicure appointment with your friend, you can pay the cancellation fee. So thinking through that kind of thing kind of makes you think, okay, is this actually worth it to me? And a lot of times it is. It's like, I get what I want. I don't have to do this thing that I just don't have it in me to do, and I'm willing to pay for it. And other times, in thinking through it in that sense, you're like, no, I should just go. And so I think that can be a really helpful way of thinking about it. And then I also feel like if you want to cancel, you kind of have to do your own little homework and think about, okay, why did I need to cancel? How did I maybe not schedule this in a way that was actually doable for me at the time? Did I think like, yeah, I'm totally going to be fine to do something on a Monday night at 8 p.m. across town? If that's, you know, like we all make those mistakes, but I think it's important to learn from it. And the next time somebody asks you to do something across town, you know, that late on a weeknight, you can say, you know, I usually don't have a lot of energy on Monday nights. Like, can we reschedule for Saturday afternoon? I'd love to see you. So making sure that you're taking a little lesson away from it and kind of communicating, I don't want this to happen again and again. I want to learn something so that I can get better next time. And I think that will make your friend feel better and will make you feel better because you know you're being a little more proactive about it.
Rachel, I want to go to one of our callers right now. We have Alex in Milwaukee. Hi, Alex.
Hey, how you doing?
Well, what did you want to bring up?
Well, I was just stating that a little inspiration that I get is I do music. I make beats, and just watching other people, even on YouTube or just outside of that, just hearing their inspiration on making their progress on making beats, trying new patterns, getting new sounds. That's just a lot of inspiration to keep going and in the field I'm in. You know, again, I'm really inspired by just watching other people get inspired. You know, that's enough inspiration within itself, I believe.
Alex, I have a quick follow-up question for you, which is when you watch other people succeed, when you succeed, how do you feel when people kind of give you, your props or kudos or anything like that?
Well, when people give me my kudos and props, you know, I feel great just because I'm learning in the process of, you know, watching other people progress. So, you know, it's kind of like a hand-in-hand thing, you know, mm-hmm. They give me my props and I give them props as well.
Alex, thank you so much for that call. So Alex is a musician and there's a community of musicians. Have you found that, you know, you can show up for your people when you have similar interests, even if you might not be close friends or anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. You know, as Alex was describing that, I was just thinking, gosh, that sounds so nice. And I feel like it's wonderful to have a hobby, but it's even better to connect with other people who share the hobby. And that's one thing that, you know, can happen. If you're on your phone, maybe you are connecting with people who are into the same thing you are, and you're really building each other up. And I've seen so much of that in Facebook groups and on Reddit that people really do. They cheer each other on and they help each other out and they offer feedback and they're proud of you when you finish the project or whatever the case may be. And they're so happy to offer advice. And so I think, you know, like I said, it's great to have a hobby, but if you can find a way to connect with other people, it's like a bonus to kind of build on that. And it does feel really good. And it makes them feel really good too.
Alex, again, thank you so much for that call at 800-642-1234. And I'm going to go back to our listeners. We have Teresa in Fond du Lac. Hi, Teresa.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, love the topic. And, I just wanted to share that I attended a seminar recently with my job, and one of the questions was, think about the way you think. And I thought that was so deep, and that was just awesome. If more people thought about the way they think and change it, you know, if something's not working, change it. You're in control of your life. You're in control of the narrative, what's going on in your head. You're in total control. One thing I did several years ago, I was in a job that was very unfulfilling, and you know, I didn't feel like they were utilizing my skills and my talents. So I couldn't leave the job. I needed the benefits and the salary, so I joined the Optimist Club, and that changed my life forever, because that's just a shift in the way you think, and you're with other people who abide by the Optimist Creed, you know.
And Teresa, did you find that that shift made it easier to make the career change, to change your life?
Yes, it did, because, volunteering outside of work helped me not think about the unhappy job day in and day out. It helped me shift my mind into doing more volunteerism and knowing that my skills and talents were going to be recognized and valued. I might not have gotten paid for it salary-wise, but I got paid for it in so many other ways that money couldn't buy, like the friends that I made, the the volunteerism, the monies we generated back for the Fond du Lac community. I mean, it was, to me, you know, volunteering is kind of what saved me, and abiding by the creed and aligning with other people who were like me. And it helped me focus not so much on the J-O-B, let's put it that way.
Teresa, thank you so much for that call, and congratulations for finding your people and for being able to make that shift in your life. Now, Rachel, what were you thinking when we were talking to Teresa just then?
Well, a couple of things jumped out at me. First is the volunteering aspect, and I've interviewed a lot of therapists throughout my career for different articles that I'm working on, and volunteering comes up again and again as a way to sort of pull yourself up when you're feeling down, when you're really stressed about the state of the world, which I think most of us are these days, that volunteering is a really, really beneficial thing to do. And so I think it's really smart that Teresa went there. You know, you get out of the mindset, you realize you're more than your day job, and you meet new people. And so it just gives you so much. So I think that's so smart and such a good tip. Then I also think that the Optimist Club thing is so interesting, in particular, because I think we often forget that, you know, commiserating with people is fun. We're all, you know, we all do it. We bond with our coworkers sometimes by complaining about things. But to do that day in and day out, it really eats away at you, and it just makes you feel really low. And so I think finding some way to shift that, whether it's making a new friend who seems more upbeat, whether it's something more formal like the Optimist Club, just recognizing, okay, I think I'm really, I hear myself, I'm complaining too much, I'm too negative, I got to change how I'm talking about things or who I'm talking to about stuff.
We're talking to Rachel Wilkerson Miller, the author of The Art of Showing Up, How to Be There for Yourself and Your People. So I feel like we have barely scratched the surface of what people can do and how they can live with more intentionality, how they can foster friendships, and really show up for those friendships, but also really take the moment to show up for themselves more consistently. You know, what did you learn as part of the process of writing this book?
Gosh, I learned so much. There's so much interesting research into how people connect and the things that they talk about. One of the things that really surprised me was interviewing a therapist named Ryan Howes about what to do with a friend who's venting too much, which I think we've all been on the receiving end of somebody who just can't stop going. And I wanted to ask him, hey, when can you kind of cut them off? And I thought it was going to be this really like, you know, you got to hear them out for this long. And he was just like, as soon as you get bored. And I was so shocked that he was just kind of like, yeah, you don't have to like sit there and listen. You can say to people, hey, I think we need to change the subject. I'm having trouble focusing. Or, you know, we've been talking about this for a while. I haven't gotten the chance to share anything with you. And I was so taken aback by that. And it was just such a good reminder that sometimes the answer is so much more simple than we think it is. Like your friend is going on and on about something day after day. You can just say, hey, I it's my turn to talk. You know, you could say it nicely, but like it's totally fine to tell people how you're feeling and they'll totally get it and it won't be a big deal. So just remembering that sometimes the answer isn't that complicated. We have the tools that we need. We just need to speak up and say something.
Now, you know, as part of writing this book, you get personal at times. Was being vulnerable, you know, part of the process? And is it something that you are going to, I guess, continue to do moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was hard for me to sort of avoid talking about what I had been through in my life. My dad died when I was young. I went through a really shocking and unexpected divorce several years ago. And both of those things really shaped how I think about these things, how I show up for myself now, and how I show up for other people. And so, you know, I felt like I had to be emotionally honest and tell people this is why I feel so strongly about this, because I've been there and I've been on the receiving end of people who showed up for me. And I've gotten the gift of being able to do it for other people. And that's so meaningful. So, you know, one of the tips in the book is that showing up takes vulnerability. And so it's important for me to practice what I preach and to be vulnerable, you know, when it's warranted and to put myself out there. I also struggle with that. If, you know, I sort of joke that I write like one personal essay a year where I share sort of more things about my life, because it's hard and it's uncomfortable, particularly to strangers. But when it comes to sharing with friends, I really try to do that. And I know it's hard, but it takes practice. But it's just in the past couple of years, I've really seen how it build such intimacy when you've got these people in your life who you care about and you trust, and you tell them, hey, I'm going through a really rough thing. It's a relief finally to tell people when you're struggling, because then they can help you and they want to help you is what you'll find out.
So, Rachel, we only have about 30 seconds left, but for people who have listened that say, hey, this sounds awesome and I want to do this, what is the first step?
I think the first step is making that choice of saying, I am worth it. And everything else stems from that. You have to prioritize it and you have to believe in it because it is hard. And there will be times when it's difficult to set boundaries or reclaim your time or say no to people. But I think if you have that like deeply held belief of this is my priority, I need to do this. This is that will set you on your path forward and everything else will follow.
Rachel, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Rachel Wilkerson Miller is a deputy editor at Vice and the author of The Art of Showing Up, How to Be There for Yourself and Your People. Now, weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Earlier this month, President Biden announced a COVID-19 vaccine and testing mandate for large companies in the United States. Host Kate Archer Kent speaks with a human resources consultant about what this could mean for companies and their employees. That's tomorrow morning after 7:30. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll take a look at what abortion regulations in Wisconsin may look like if the U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe versus Wade. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Thank you so much for joining us.